And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm glad to welcome Michael Cardos back to the program today. Michael is the co-director of the Creative Writing Program at Mississippi State University. He's written a textbook for creative writing and has published a collection of short stories as well as three novels. We've interviewed Michael before about The Three-Day Affair and Before He Finds Her. Today we'll be talking about the newest one, Bluff, which is published by The Mysterious Press. Michael, Bluff is the story of a struggling magician, Natalie Webb. What do you think's holding her back from making the big time?
She has a little self-destructive tendency, I think. And part of it's she is a close-up magician, and I don't know how many close-up magicians can make the big time if you're not doing the big, making elephants and jet planes disappear.
Yeah, it took Ricky Jay a long time to get into the public mind.
Yeah, and a lot of that had to do with movies, and, if you're in Deadwood, it helps.
And also having a documentary made about you.
And a documentary made about you, yeah.
Yeah, I remember I saw Penn and Teller at the Orpheum Theater here in Memphis a couple of years ago, and Teller was doing some close-up magic, and I was in the back row, and it was just lost on me.
Was there a TV monitor?
No, there wasn't.
Mm-hmm. And then you're watching it on TV. You're not really seeing it.
But it's fun watching it on TV when you can, close in on the hands.
Yeah, I have an interesting relationship with close-up magic because I love it, and it's something that as a kid I was really into and involved with, and yet there are certain illogical things about close-up. Like you pick up a quarter with your right hand and you pass it to your left hand, but really secretly you keep it in your right hand. And the question I always had is, why don't you just pick it up with your left hand to start? Right? I mean, if you're really trying to make it look like realism, why would you ever transfer an object from one hand to the other to begin with? And so there's this sort of like, you have to buy into the conceit of it and then let yourself sort of believe that you're being, swayed by it.
Well, there's kind of a visual momentum to it because, I mean, as a writer and storyteller, you have to rely on a narrative momentum that people assume that things happen in between scenes that they don't necessarily happen. Mm-hmm. We don't see your characters going to the bathroom and then every meal they eat and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's real white space and implied white space. And that's funny. I have two little kids, and sometimes they'd like to do magic to me, and it's always like, all right, I'm going to pick this up. Now close your eyes. And so they make me do the white space. I close my eyes so they can do the magic trick.
So how did you get into close-up magic when you were a kid?
I think I always liked it. And then the first show I ever saw in New York, I was probably, 8 or 9, was The Magic Show starring Doug Henning. When I was 12, I guess I would have been 12 or 13, my 8th grade English teacher was a magician. He used to perform at a local restaurant, and he started a magic club with 3 of us after school. So we'd hang out once a week, and he'd show us, the basics of sleight of hand and tell us what books to read and all that. And then I got pretty into it for a while. And then in a couple summers in high school, I lived in, New Jersey on the shore, and my summer job was doing tricks on the boardwalk. And that was probably my peak. It was about 15, 16. And it was kind of magical downhill after that.
Now, you're also an accomplished musician as well as a magician. I remember Robbie Fulks, a country musician, once said, "It takes a lot of hard work to make it look this easy."
Yeah. My favorite magic quote, which I'm going to misquote a little bit, is from Teller, actually, which is amazing to hear him talk in the first place. But he was on the radio, and I heard him say something like, "The thing about magic is it has to be perfect before you can evaluate whether it's any good." This idea that for the illusion to really even be able to evaluate it, right, you have to practice and practice and practice until it's flawless. And I think there is something about magic and about performing music and writing too, is that you want it to appear effortless. And often that's, you got to work really hard to make it look effortless.
And so what was the challenge for you trying to write magic on the page?
Well, one thing is that it's visual. It's magic and it's poker in this book, and they're both very visual. So trying to describe it, I cheated once because there's a poker hand that I just ended up drawing. I found I was using too many words to describe it, so I just made an illustration. But certainly for the magic, it was trying to describe something amazing with only words, and then trying to figure out how much the reader needed to know about various things, what to call things. That was more of an issue in the poker too, right? What do I assume the reader is going to know about Texas Hold'em, or even about what hand beats what other hand? And, so there's a lot of kind of decisions about that.
Well, it seems like several years ago you couldn't get away from Texas Hold'em is all over television.
Mm-hmm. I think it still is. I think people don't pay as much attention to it, but you can't really flip the channels without some World Series of Poker game being on. And yet, it's funny. I think it's a little bit generational. I talk to people of different age, and their frame of reference is still 5-card draw or something else.
Seven card stud.
Seven card stud for sure. Yeah, for me growing up, it was definitely seven card stud.
You had a bunch of poker knowledge before you started writing this?
I had more magic knowledge. My magic help I needed was making sure I was calling things the right words, but I had a basic understanding of the of a lot of the moves in magic. In poker, my knowledge was really just being a very, very casual player to begin with. So I read a lot, and I talked to a lot of poker players at different levels, because it's so different if you're a professional in a casino versus someone who goes to home games versus someone who plays on the internet. You're going to handle the same hand. You're going to bet differently. So I talked to a number of poker players, people who thought they were good that weren't as good, people who were I was interested in how the play would work, but also what the milieu was like, because in this book, in Bluff, there's a couple of different games, and the last one is a really high stakes, fancy game at someone's mansion. I was like, what does that room look like? You know, I know when I would play, there might be a football game on, but would there be a game on if the stakes were that high? Would they be more focused on the play of the game, and just a lot of what kind of table would it be? You know, is the fancy table the kind with the recessed felt for the cup, or is that just my imagination of what a fancy table would look like, and would it actually be flat, or would it be oval? Or so just a lot of the kind of look and feel of the room.
I've always disliked poker because it seems a game of dishonesty with bluffing and such, because you're going to lie to me, and then I'm going to give you my money. Whereas with fiction, I give you my money, then you lie to me, and I'm much happier with that arrangement.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because people have written before about the idea of writing and magic having similarities. Tim O'Brien has an essay I love called The Magic Show, where he kind of talks about being a kid magician and how it was similar in a way to being a fiction writer. And I was thinking about that, but which I agreed with, but also I was thinking how it does have something to do with being a con artist, because the thing about the con is that you, to do it right, like the big con, like in The Sting, you have to draw in your mark, but also you have to send them away and let them willingly come back, right? They have to do it right, you can't just take them for what they have on them. They have to trust you so much and believe in you and believe in themselves that they're going to go away and take everything and come on back on their own and give you everything. And I feel like in a way, if someone's going to read a novel and invest 10, 12, 14 hours of their life, which is an unbelievable amount of time on your words, they have to trust that they're going to go for a good ride. You know, they have to trust you. And the end of chapter one, I think, is like that moment where they can close the book or go away, but you want them to come back and keep going. I wrote a piece for Crime Reads, which is like the Lit Hub that's for crime writing now. And I was trying to work through some of these issues. And I think the biggest difference is that, you know, in a con, the mark loses. Right? You know, with a book, it's similarities, but the similarity breaks down that everybody wins. You know, they can come back and the reader kind of is glad to have been taken at the end of the day.
I've heard a couple of contrasting quotes about con men and such, is that you can't sucker an honest man. Mm-hmm. But the other one is, any man with dignity makes an easy mark.
Yeah. Yeah, or, you know, the honest man thinks he's an honest man until he comes across the right opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Only as honest as opportunities
yeah,
are.
Yeah, something like that.
It's like men are only as faithful as their opportunities
yeah,
are.
Yeah, Chris Rock, I think.
Natalie, at the beginning of the book, is working a corporate gig. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the worst group of people to do a gig for.
Yeah. This is something we were talking earlier about a friend of ours, Michael Farris Smith. And he's another Mississippi writer, and we're pals. And the one thing I always admire about him is how he can just think of the worst thing to do to a character. And it doesn't seem sadistic, but it seems like just really good for a story to get things going. And so I had him on the mind a little bit when I was thinking, like, all right, I have this magician whose career is already going south, and she's made some bad decisions, and she's doing this corporate gig. Who would be the worst? And she's going to injure somebody. What's the worst group of people she could be doing this for? And it's a room full of personal injury attorneys. It just seemed like a nice way to begin, you know. So she gets herself in hot water with a personal injury attorney who's going to know exactly how to take care of this.
Well, and he does her the grave insult of trying to ruin her trick.
Yeah, he's the worst kind of heckler, you know. He's a kid, basically. He wants to be center stage, and he wants the show to be about him. And she's used to handling hecklers. She does bachelor parties. She does all kind of unsavory gigs for money. But But for a number of reasons, this particular show gets under her skin, and part of it's because it wasn't supposed to be that kind of show. It was supposed to be a holiday party. It was supposed to be fun. It was supposed to be good money, easy money. And then so she just reacts badly.
Now, in the past, we've seen many more male magicians than we have seen women magicians. Did you talk to them about the particular challenges that women have in performing?
Yeah, I did, and especially in the area of poker as well. So, you know, a lot of it was the fact that both magic and poker, right, are professions where they're mainly men. And so a woman would have distinct challenges there. Not only are they mainly men, but they're both environments that don't necessarily treat women in those professions all that well. So to me, the book was in part about misogyny and about how she would negotiate all that and ideally turn people's expectations about her into some sort of an advantage.
Recently on Twitter, there was an ongoing mocking of the way male novelists write about women and how they consider their own bodies in the stories.
Yeah.
And I was really happy when I read yours that you didn't fall into those traps.
No, I mean, yeah, I was laughing. I was reading those too and really laughing. But my gosh, like, I just wanted to make her a really particular individual. And I think, and I don't want to oversimplify it because I think that there are challenges writing across gender, you know, and I certainly had more readers on this novel than I had on other ones. But I think at the end of the day, you know, if you can make a character absolutely distinct, a lot of the issues, you know, rather than making her a woman, you know, a lot of the issues start to fade away a little bit.
Instead of a woman, she's this woman.
Yeah, she is Natalie.
But her body does play into this because she is tall for a woman. And so I assume with larger hands, she'd be able to do more conceals and stuff like that.
That's right. And it does mention that makes her sleight of hand a little bit more effective because she can conceal cards in a certain way. And I don't want to spoil anything, but she does meet another woman in the novel who is smaller. And so it affects the way that she does work with the cards.
So card companies haven't made cards for ladies?
Well, there are bridge cards. They do act. I mean, think about this. Bridge cards and poker cards. And bridge cards are thinner.
I did not realize
that. I don't know what the exact dimensions are, but when you buy poker cards, they're thicker. They're wider than bridge cards.
What's better for magic?
Better for magic, I don't know. But the backs of the cards are better when they are borderless. You can get bordered cards and borderless cards. So most cards are bordered. They have a little white border. The borderless cards have the pattern going all the way, like the bleed all the way to the edge. And that makes it better for magic because it's harder to tell when one card starts to move over another card.
I went to a writer's workshop and they wanted us to read this book on stage magic as part of our writing education. And the thing that I remember the most from it was they said, if you can find a card in 100 different ways, but can only present it one way, you have one trick. But if you can find a card one way and present it 100 ways, you have 100 tricks.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like with close-up magic, I mean, how many opportunities do you have to find a card?
A lot of card tricks boil down to someone takes a card and then the magician finds it. That's the trick. Sometimes they're forces, sometimes they're not, sometimes, right? But sometimes the reveal is so interesting, right? Sometimes it's folded up inside of a lemon. Sometimes it's, you know, in the deck. Sometimes it's
in a fish,
you know. I think those kinds of, it's the performance more than the moves. And I think one thing about Natalie is that she, in this book, is that she is really focused on the moves. I mean, she is a purist, obsessive about the moves, and sometimes that's to her detriment. I think that one thing that she learns over the course of the novel is that the performance kind of matters too. It's not just being a master at the moves.
Yeah, it seems that in the con game, the social engineering part is just as big as the actual moving of items.
Absolutely.
Because of her performance in front of the personal injury attorneys, she meets another attorney named Brock McKnight.
Yes.
And he sounds like a local news anchor.
This is Brock McKnight with the weather. Yeah.
Brock has a proposition for
her. Yeah, Brock watches her show, and he's the one attorney to kind of not come to her defense, but offer to represent her after she injures this other lawyer.
He sees an opportunity for some money.
It is. He seems like, hey, you know, I'll take care of this. Don't worry. By the way, how'd you do that trick with the four queens? So, you know, he's a magic fan and he wants to know how she did the trick. And so he kind of proposes that if you tell me how this trick is done, maybe I can help you out. And she won't tell him. So he kind of sweetens the deal a little bit. But ultimately, he has the key, which is that he plants this idea in her head. He knows a card cheat and thinks that she might want to meet that cheat because if she's a really good magician and not living that well, she might do a lot better as a card cheat.
And the card cheat has a name every bit as cheesy as his name. It's Ace.
Yeah, it's funny. I knew I wanted to name him Ace because it's so ridiculous. And he is a pretty...
And apologies to Ace Atkins. We're talking about a card guy being called
if
Ace.
If you happen to be a card cheat, you know, going by the name Ace is not the best way to hide your identity. What I didn't realize until I had a draft of the book done is that her magic mentor's name is Jack. And
I didn't even catch that.
It was not something that occurred to me until I was all the way done with the draft. And obviously something was going on subconsciously.
But Ace takes her to a poker game at a bakery, of all places, in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Who all is at the poker game?
Well, it's one of those games. It's not super high stakes. It's some guys who live normal lives but are in a little too deep. So they're playing. You know, she might win a couple $1,000 if she plays it right. But Ace fancies himself as this, you know, he's going to teach her what he does. The idea is that in the novel is that Natalie, to make some extra cash, gets this gig writing a magazine article where she's going to profile a card cheat. And so Ace is supposed to be this card cheat that she follows and learns from, and he acts sort of like the mentor you would expect in like a Karate Kid kind of thing, where he knows his role and he's going to make her suffer a little bit, but make her so much wiser. And so he takes her to this game, and he's just a mess. And he is not the card shark that he has represented himself to be.
Now, there's a small whale who's there. Mm-hmm. He's a guy that is pretty free with his money when he's gambling, it seems.
Yeah, I knew that there'd be two poker games in this novel, you know, really dramatized, and they kind of mirror each other in certain ways. And the first one, yeah, I thought the bakery would be a fun place. I've never read a poker bakery scene before, and I know a baker. And what got me thinking about it was that I knew at one point the guy who owned the bakery was going to be so into his own story about how to make good sourdough that it was going to provide all sorts of misdirection for people to do things with the cards.
And then his niece is there, and she's having problems with her marriage, and maybe not appropriate for the game.
Yeah, Ellen is, you know, so see these guys who fancy themselves real serious poker players, and in walks this young woman, Ellen, who's a kindergarten teacher. And she's visiting her uncle, and as long as she's there, he gives her her steak, and so she sits down, and she's just, her first thing that she says to everyone is, you know, if we get tired of poker, maybe we can all play some euchre. And that's the kind of character that she kind of comes across as.
I've always heard of euchre, but I don't know how to play the game.
I think it's, a lot of people in the Midwest play euchre, I think. I learned it in Ohio. It does involve some sort of trumps and suits, but it's not really the gambling game.
So it's more like spades?
Yeah, something like that.
All sorts of things go down at this game, but Natalie ends up home, and to add insult to injury, because something bad happens to her at the game, her friend who lives upstairs, Harley, well, that's actually her neighbor, they're not too close, Harley, she does a good deed that comes and is a bad deal for Natalie.
Yeah, Harley, her upstairs neighbor, is a vet tech and always taking in stray dogs, and Natalie comes home from this game only to be attacked by this stray dog. Then Harley, the neighbor, says, oh, you know, he's really not a biter. And Natalie's like, he is. He just bit me. So I love that. I figured dog owners are always doing that, right? Their dog attacks you. And you're like, oh, my dog doesn't attack. Like, your dog just attacked.
It doesn't until it does.
Right.
No good deed goes unpunished, it seems. And then also she's got a someone adding some color into her life, a little punk rocker with a blue mohawk.
Yeah, yeah. To back up, attentive readers of pet names, I think the dog's name in that was Mustard, which was the name of Ira Levin's Mustard and the Boys from Brazil, the dog that attack at the end.
Oh, wow.
It was Mustard. When the kid says Mustard, I think they don't attack. And he says Ketchup, they attack. I couldn't resist that. Yeah, the boy is this sort of just kind of wasted away, just this, I don't know. How would you describe him?
He's almost like a gutter punk who has a home.
Yeah, that sounds right. And he befriends Natalie just because he happens to live across the way.
Well, he tries to run a con on her first thing he meets her.
he meets her and he says, you know, it's November. And he meets her and says, you know, give me $100, I'll shovel your walk and shovel your car out. She's like, it's not snowing. He's like, well, yeah, but pay me now. And then when it snows, I'll come back. And I think that kind of endears her to him because it's such a ridiculous proposition.
And she tears up a bill?
She tears up a bill and she gives him a quarter of it. And she says, hang on to this and come back. I'll give you another quarter. And of course, what we learn as the reader is that $100 bill minus a quarter of it is still a $100 bill. So she hasn't really given him anything or given anything away.
Yeah, I remember hearing from a kid, as long as you had 51%
of
the bill,
you could have a little more than half.
You could get it redeemed. Now, we also learn a lot about her family life growing up and some pretty tragic stories there.
Yeah, Natalie feels responsible in a way for setting her parents on the path that they went on. Her parents were having some trouble, and her dad hurt his. He moved pianos for a career after getting fired from a job, more of a business kind of job. But so he's moving pianos, and because of Natalie, or at least she feels that way, his hands got crushed in an accident with a freight elevator. And that kind of set him on a downward spiral. And so she kind of grew up in that environment. So she left home pretty early as this magician. And when she was 17 years old, she was really world class. She had won an international competition, and she saw her life as one of sort of getting away and being this, you know, unique character, this professional touring magician. And then pretty quickly things took a turn. So by the time the novel opens and she's 27 years old, she really feels like she's, you know, old in a way. And we're talking earlier, when I was 27, I certainly felt old. I think 27 was my oldest year. I think I knew 30 was coming up eventually. For some reason, that age, and I was thinking all about all the people who didn't make it past 27, which Natalie reflects on at one point, all the musicians and all the comedians and all the people who didn't make it. And so I think she's feeling kind of old and doesn't see where her career is going to go by the time she's 27. And that's kind of, we learned that pretty early in the novel.
Well, and you mentioned musician, and there's a musician who haunts the story early on, and it's a retired musician who's turned entrepreneur, and that's Victor Flowers.
Mm-hmm.
His name kind of comes up, and it just really evokes a visceral reaction.
Yeah, Natalie. Victor Flowers is this crooner from the 50s and 60s, then went into the music business and made a fortune, and he's running for office. And Natalie and her family have this kind of interesting relationship with Victor Flowers, and she's kind of aware of that for the first chunk of the novel. And in some way, Victor Flowers was really the one who was responsible for her dad's downward spiral.
Your first two novels, very good, but also very serious mm-hmm. in their way. This one has a lot of laughs and a lot of fun along the way. How is it different writing something with a lighter tone to it?
It was fun. It really was. I think one thing that I always felt was difficult was I really like writing crime stuff. You know, I find that putting a crime in a novel gives it stakes, it gives it intensity, it gives it momentum, it does things for plot, it does things for character. But I found it very hard to write a story that was really important to the main character and yet had levity or humor in it, because crimes, by their very definition, are not humorous, especially real crimes where people can die. And so I couldn't figure out a way to have something both very serious with a crime that also would have humor in it without the humor somehow undermining or making light of the crime, which I never wanted to do. I think with this novel, part of it has to do with just the milieu. I mean, there's sort of the magic and the poker, there's sort of a built-in, baked-in absurdity to it that sort of lended itself to humor. I think something had to do with the character. And who knows, maybe just because I don't know exactly, but just the even from the first chapter, there's a little bit of kind of absurd noir-ish to it that I couldn't take. You know, I think even that character couldn't take her own situation 100% seriously because she's smart enough to see the absurdity in it.
In writing scenes that are funny, mm-hmm. did you have to vet them with all your readers, or were you convinced that they were funny?
No, I was convinced. I'd written, you know, outside, I write a lot of stories, and often my stories have humor in them. So I've written a lot of humorous things, just not necessarily the first two novels. I cut some jokes. I cut one of my favorite jokes in the novel just because it ended up in revision. It didn't quite work. So I cut some of the, there are a few lines that I'm sorry I missed because they're really funny, but they didn't help the scene ultimately. So I cut them.
Can you salvage them for anything else?
Probably.
Or are they just so specific to the scenes?
Okay, there's one exchange where, this is in the second chapter, where the lawyer at one point comes back from the bathroom. And I had this line where he says, like, you know, I'm not a magician, but blah, 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 blah. And her response is, I'm not a lawyer, but your fly is down. And I just thought that was kind of a funny line. But it didn't fit the tone by the time I was ready with the scene, so I cut it.
A little shticky.
Yeah, it's shticky. That's right. I think the shtick had to go. Right.
So I saw on Twitter today that it's the 39th anniversary of the opening of the Mysterious Bookshop.
Yes.
And its owner is also Otto Penzler, who's your editor. Mm-hmm. What is it like working with Otto?
It's great. I mean, he's really supportive. Like with this manuscript, he was very positive. He had a couple sort of general comments that sent me back doing some more writing, but kind of really trusts, I assume it's like this with all of his writers, trusts his writers to figure out what to do and the solutions and everything. But mainly he's been great. He's a real cheerleader for the books and has been wonderful.
Now, a few years ago, you wrote a text for creative writing. Mm-hmm. How many of those rules did you break when you're writing this book?
Probably all of them. But I say in the textbook, right in the first chapter, you know, the rules are, there are no rules. These aren't rules. These are conventions that writers have found have been very helpful over many hundreds of years. But there are, you know, you can do what you can do. Flannery O'Connor said you can do anything as long as you can get away with it. You just can't usually get away with that much. So, right. But, no, I think, honestly, I tend to follow my own advice because my own advice gives lots of room for exceptions.
Now, you teach creative writing. You're the co-director of the program down mm-hmm. there. How did the school react to that heartbreaking loss in the women's championship
game? I'm still feeling it viscerally. People are still talking about it, and whether it was more of a heartbreak this year or last year, and to me, there's no comparison. This year was so much harder because they really – They knew they could win it. You know, it was such a great season though. And my 7-year-old this year was old enough to go to games. So we went to a ton of home games this year, and it was super cool.
It's kind of rude to do this just as you've put out one book, but are you working on another one right now?
Yeah, I mean, I am, for the main reason that the one thing I've learned is that when a book comes out, I really, really want to be working on something else because it kind of keeps me focused and grounded and sane. So I'm not far in, but I'm working on what I think is going to be a novel about the world's largest art museum theft / heist.
When did this take place?
I think it's taking place reasonably nowish. I mean, not now.
Oh, okay. So it's a fictional.
Yes. Yes, it's fictional, taking place reasonably, you know, within the past few years. And I haven't decided if I'm going to name the city. It's a Midwestern city, mid-sized city with a good art museum.
Kansas City. I've been to theirs.
I've considered Kansas
nice.
City, yeah.
And been to the Cincinnati one, yep. And that's nice mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. The first time I ever went to the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City, mm-hmm. I spent about 6 hours in there. And then when I left, I actually took up a guide on the way out. And it says, this museum has the largest collection of Asian art between San Francisco and Chicago. And I didn't see any Asian art. That's how big.
That's how big it is. Yeah, I know how the crime's going to be done. I don't know a lot else, but I think I know I think I know whose story it's going to be and all that. But
is it going to be more serious or with a lighter tone?
I'm hoping it has kind of everything. I think it's going to, this novel, you know, Bluff is one point of view character throughout. And this one that I'm just specking out, I think is going to be from four different perspectives. The director of the museum, one of the artists whose work is being displayed told his journal entries, the security, head of security told as a police transcript, and a cafeteria worker in the cafeteria in the museum. So, and then kind of their stories are going to kind of work collage-like.
So have you done epistolary before?
I have. I mean, other than just, you know, sometimes there's an email or a text or something thrown into a story, but I've never done a large chunk of, you know, letters or journal entries.
Well, Michael, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing Bluff with us. It's a highly entertaining book, and I'm really happy that this one looks like it's going to do some things for you.
Oh, thanks so much, Stephen. Really appreciate it.
Michael Cardos is the author of the novel Bluff, which is published by the Mysterious Press. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.